Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today I've dragged in Russell Chinelli to be the co-host because we have a special guest. His name is Hector Abruña, and he is from Cornell University, grew up in Puerto Rico, and is a specialist on materials, batteries, things of this nature. So, Hector, welcome to Science Studio.
Then welcome to the whole audience.
Right, five of us. Before we get onto batteries, before we get onto your expertise as a scientist, maybe an entrepreneur for all I know, tell us a little bit about Hector. When you were a kid, how on earth did you become
so
in
I'll
the sciences?
Start with nicknames. So most people call me Tito, T-I-T-O. And the way that evolves is when I was much younger, the diminutive form of Hector in Spanish is Hector, so from Hector, Tito. So
okay, I didn't know that.
There we go.
I always think of Tito as the ex-president of Yugoslavia.
The one time I said, you know, to a woman who asked me, are you from Yugoslavia? I said, yes. And then she started speaking Serbo-Croatian. I had no idea what she was talking about. The one time, you know, but because, you know, that's also a common, you know. Jeff Brosses Tito, yes. So I was born and raised in Puerto Rico. I went to school in Puerto Rico through high school, and then for college, I went to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in upstate New York. Very cold. I mean, my idea of winter until that time was less warm, you know. So winters in Puerto Rico might be 70, you know. I think the coldest recorded temperature in San Juan is like 58 ever.
Wow.
And so that was a shock. Certain things one remembers. The smell of chapstick till the day I die means winter, because I never used it before. From there, I went to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, as they call it, the southern part of heaven. I got a PhD there. And from there, I went not far from here, University of Texas at Austin, as a postdoc with Alan Bard.
One of the world's great electrochemists. So you do a lot of electrochemistry,
yes,
I'm sure.
Actually, in graduate school, I worked with Royce Mary and Tom Meyer. So I had two advisors, Royce, an electrochemist, Tom Meyer, inorganic chemist who does a lot of electrochemistry. So my entire career, formal career, was in electrochemistry.
But you've moved very quickly. That was a minute and a half, and we've gone all the way through your educational bio. I'd like to hear from you. You were 10. You were 9. What were the things that then decided you on a course for higher education and science?
My father was a soil chemist, and so we would engage in, you know, quote-unquote scientific discussions at that age. And I remember he would bring stuff from his lab that I would play with, and this is the proverbial, I almost burned down the garage one day, so I figured this looks like fun. And also remember, do you remember those Gilbert chemistry sets? Do you remember those?
Oh, sure.
I don't.
Right? So I remember having one of those. And in those days, I mean, you had real chemicals. You could hurt yourself. And I remember having so much fun with that. And the ones that, you know, like two drawers and then the little, you know, plastic balance and all of these other nonsense. So that was sort of, I think, an early introduction to chemistry as an experimental science, which I really enjoyed.
You know, it reminds me, too, when I was about 12, I got a kilogram of sodium metal.
Wow.
I don't remember how I got it, but I began throwing it in buckets and experimenting. And one day I threw a big piece in a bucket, and next thing I felt on my head, little volcanoes. But that experience, which you're talking about, was one thing that led you into batteries.
I see. There we go.
Did you ever have a chunk of lithium you played with?
I wasn't that fortunate.
So, who turned you on to the science, apart from your father, which is unusual, because quite often children try to avoid doing anything that their parents found interesting.
Our parents, you know, really encouraged us just to be inquisitive. And in those days, it was common, you know, to, as a Christmas gift, to get, you know, one of these Gilbert chemistry sets. And I look at those days, and, you know, you can actually find, you know, descriptions of what was in those kits. Not a chance that you could sell that today, because, you know, the legislation, you know, would not, you know, allow you to do that.
We should come back to that towards the end of the program, because this erring on the side of caution and safety, you know, I understand it, but I also think it's taken a lot away from the experience of young people.
It can really prevent, you know, people from exploring other things. You know, it's sort of reminiscent of, you know, having graduate students, which is really now, you know, fast forwarding a lot. But the way I describe, you know, how I treat grad students is give them enough rope to explore but not enough to hang themselves.
Tell us a little bit about your undergraduate at Rensselaer Poly. Did you do undergraduate research?
Yes. And that also then is sort of my first introduction to electrochemistry. So actually, I got interested in chemistry because I had a very good instructor or teacher in high school. His name was Father Ouellette. And this was in high school in San Juan. And so when I went to Rensselaer, I think I started doing undergraduate research at the end of my junior year. There was this professor, Dave Aikens, who was also an electrochemist. And I remember taking a course with him. I thought he was just the smartest guy around. And I says, well, if he's an electrochemist, there must be something to that. And so I did some work in his labs. And it was really, really a real introduction to the research, where some things worked, others didn't. I made a lot of stupid mistakes, like everybody does.
Sometimes those stupid mistakes lead to publications.
True, yes, yes. And then when I was thinking of applying to graduate school, he had been a postdoc at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. So after one of these brutal storms, he comes over and says, you'll never see this in Chapel Hill. And so I applied to UNC in Chapel Hill, and I was admitted, and I had a great, great time in graduate school there as well.
It's interesting, UNC Chapel Hill, when I was paying attention to these details, has the largest number of BS chemistry majors every year.
Yeah.
Followed
by
University in Puerto Rico in
that's
San
right,
Juan.
That's
phenomenal numbers.
Yes.
You know, we have 10 and they have 150, and I'm thinking this is enormous. So, you're an electrochemist. Tell the audience what you mean by electrochemistry, because that sounds like a little bit of physics, a little bit of chemistry.
Right.
What is electrochemistry?
So actually, you know, it borrows a lot from the languages of many disciplines, particularly solid-state physics and material sciences. If I were to describe, you know, the quote-unquote, the Webster definition, it's the study of charges crossing interfaces, I think would be probably the simplest one. And so a couple of things there. One is charges move. And the other one is that you're crossing an interface. And so now you have already defining the problem, and that is what is happening at that interface, because it controls everything, the energetics, the transport. And so understanding those phenomena is basically what as electrochemists we do as a discipline. People have a lot of experience with electrochemistry on their everyday life. You can ask anybody, you know, do you use batteries? And they're all going to say, of course I do, and I hate them because they're not as good as they should be. And so, well, that's an electrochemical device, and you can try to explain to them, you know, how they work, why some are better than others. A while back, in my early days in academia, it was very difficult to get research support for electrochemistry. It was considered, you know, like a tool more than anything else, and so it was very hard. But now people have realized the key role that it plays in both at a fundamental level and also in real-world applications, things like fuel cells or batteries or OLEDs or solar conversion. So all of these things have converged into a real impetus on understanding all of that interfacial phenomena. And basically, that's what we do.
So you would recommend to a young student now that's going off to graduate school that electrochemistry is something that's...
These are smart kids. They have figured it out by themselves.
Well. So did you work with lithium batteries?
Not at that time. As I recall, when I first started research as an undergraduate, I was trying to make ion selective electrodes, which was the rage at that time. This is in the 70s. And then when I was in graduate school, it was this burgeoning field of so-called chemically modified electrodes. And then as a postdoc, I did photoelectrochemistry, so looking at light-induced electron transfer interfaces. And things have evolved, you know, over the years. The emphasis now in my laboratories is materials development for fuel cells and batteries. But in the interim, we've worked a lot with a wide range of materials. One of the things that I will always credit, you know, Chapel Hill was that I had two advisors, electrochemist Royce Merry and an inorganic chemist, Tom Meyer. And in Meyer's group, I learned to lose the fear of synthesis. And so we're probably one of the few groups that actually makes stuff and then looks at it. More often than not, you have groups that make stuff. We have groups that analyze stuff. We can do basically, you know, one-stop shopping. And we might not be elegant and our yields might be poor, but we get from A to Z. And that makes a big, big difference. And students appreciate that because they see the entire process. And if they have a question, they know they can walk across to the next bench, you know, how do I solve this? And so you generate, you know, a knowledge base that then gets integrated.
Talk to a little about, Hector, the smart electrodes, the electrodes that can be modified, as you put, and so okay. You can put receptors on there and look for specific compounds. Yeah.
So the first question is, why would you want to do that, right? And so, again, you know, when I teach the electrochemistry course, I tell them, you know, a philosophical question. Is electrochemistry a high-resolution or low-resolution technique? And students have no idea what I'm saying.
Because they're thinking of NMR spectra.
So then I use NMR as an example. So you say, how many of you have run NMR spectrum? Everybody. How about a C13 NMR? Enough of them. You know, so what are typical C13, you know, signals? They're just...
lines.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, hair thin, right? Over a very broad range. And you can distinguish them, you know, incredibly well. That, to me, is a high-resolution technique. In electrochemistry, right? What's a window over which you can oxidize and reduce? And I said, let's be generous. Let's say 4 volts, okay? What's a typical width of the redox process? Nernst tells you it's 59 millivolts. You divide 4,000 by 59 or 60, not that many things. So by definition, low resolution.
That's a good explanation. Right. I shall remember that.
But then on the other hand, you can do very precise measurements because it's easy to count electrons. So you have high sensitivity, but low selectivity. So what do? You can then modify the surface to endow that interface with the properties of the modifier. And so they've been used for analysis, for sensors, for biosensors, for catalysis. So that basically is taking, and then the question is, can you translate homogeneous solution chemistry to two dimensions, which is the electrode surface? Some cases you can, others not, depends on the nature of the interface.
So anyway, then when you're talking about the materials, I just kind of got stuck before. You're talking about the interfaces in batteries,
right,
of the big materials area, something that lets lithium pass or
right.
Sodium. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So in the specific case of batteries, so batteries are very complex structures. And just to make sure that for the audience, so you have an anode, typically called the negative electrode, a separator, typically some polymer membrane, a liquid that conducts ions, and then the cathode or positive electrode. And so you basically make a little sandwich or some structure of this, and then charges can move through that whole surface, through that whole structure.
And then externally, electrons move.
Electrons move externally,
the
ions move internally.
Right. Okay, that sets up the second part of the program. We have to take a break here. Keith Pannell, Russ Chinelli, Hector Abrunia from Cornell University. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. We may be taking our skin for granted. Yes, we know it's the largest organ, but other than wanting our skin to look good, it doesn't rank up there with the heart and the brain.
But scientists may have discovered an important role the skin plays that we never knew about. Our skin may be helping to regulate blood pressure and heart rate.
That's pretty neat, and it's important because 1 out of 3 Americans faces high blood pressure, also known as hypertension, which contributes to nearly 400,000 deaths every year.
The reality is, outside of obesity and smoking, the cause of a vast majority of hypertension cases is unknown. We know it's connected to the reduced blood flow to small blood vessels in parts of the body that are far from the heart, including the skin.
When tissues like the skin are starved for oxygen, the body reacts by increasing the flow of blood, which causes high blood pressure. This reaction to get more blood is regulated by a family of proteins called HIF, which are also found in the skin.
To study whether HIF proteins in the skin affect blood flow, researchers created mice missing these proteins. When these mice were exposed to low oxygen, as expected, their blood pressure, heart rate, and skin temperature were all negatively affected since their HIF proteins did not do the job of increasing blood flow.
This goes to show that the skin does regulate blood pressure and heart rate according to the oxygen levels in the blood.
Learning this role that the skin plays might reveal new insights into the causes of hypertension and perhaps lead to new therapies to combat this common ailment. Controlling blood pressure is key to reducing the chances of having a stroke, heart attacks, and damage to the circulatory system.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Hector Abrunia from Cornell University, electrochemist, materials chemist, batteries chemist, etc., etc. So you've explained to us what a battery is in that first part. Now, what's your interest in these and why do they keep exploding?
It's interesting because you remember when the Galaxy 7s were catching on fire?
Yes.
So those were my 13 seconds of fame because somebody, you know, I think NBC called Cornell, says, do you have anybody who knows a little bit about batteries? So the Cornell propaganda office calls me, you know. And so Cornell has this little studio right in town, so I always keep a jacket just in case for those occasions. So we went there.
And I can tell the audience, he's got a nice striped shirt, dark blue and white. He's got a nice tie, which is red and black and blue, and a beautiful blazer with the flag of Puerto Rico, I think,
yes,
on there.
And the rendition of a coqui from the Native Indians.
Ah, that I hadn't picked up on.
And so, I mean, I had been asked that question, you know, a number of times in the past. And typically, when it's just the energy density of a battery is enormous. And so all batteries operate beyond the thermodynamic stability limit of its components. And so what you're trying to do is basically harness this without letting it, you know, run its course. And so in the case of the Galaxy 7s in particular, if you look at any cell phone, people don't care if it weighs a little bit more, a bit less, but they want it thin because that's really sleek, right? And so that means lower volume. And so in assembling the batteries, the separator, this membrane, they cut it a little too close. It was a little too thin. And so when they pressurize it, it could actually get punctured, which would give rise to a dead short. The other one in the assembly, each electrode has a little tab, and that's what you make connections to. In the quality control was not so good. In some cases, they were so close to each other that they could short. And so if you give it a reason, it'll go. But then,
so those are the ones that you're not allowed to carry on the airplanes these
right,
days.
That's right.
Is that still in effect?
Okay, Galaxy 7s are no longer available. I mean, Samsung bought them all back.
So Galaxy 8, is that where we are now?
Are
they thicker? Less sexy?
That's right. They're a little bit, if you look, they're a little bit thicker. Yeah, I think they learned the lesson. But then the real line was, you know, in talking to these folks, my standard line is, you know, da-da-da-da happens, and before you know it, you have barbecue in your pocket. And the people from NBC just love that line. So we practiced for like 20 minutes just, you know, barbecue in your pocket. So they extracted like 10 seconds out of the whole interview, and that's what got on.
And who said scientists didn't know how to coin a phrase?
And so what we look at is studying those interfaces in great detail. So, for example, most of the batteries right now are based on a so-called intercalation anode. And what that means is that you have a structure that can expand or contract, and then you insert lithium ions. The analogy that I use is imagine a club sandwich and you're putting in cherry tomatoes. The scaling is about right. And so if you put a cherry tomato, the sandwich will expand a little bit. If you take them out, it'll contract a little bit. And there's a limit as to how many you can put in before it gets unstable, so to speak. And so then you move that between that and then an intercalation carbon anode. There's a limit on the capacity of those things, which is what, you know, people want batteries that have infinite capacity, infinite power, last forever and cost nothing. Those are the design parameters, right? And so the advances in this more traditional materials, in my view, is more evolutionary. I think the big jumps have been made, and that landscape has been scoured, you know, tremendously. So you can get a little bit better, but I don't think you're going to have a huge increase. And so there, new approaches have been brought to bear. The one I, in particular, I'm very partial to is lithium sulfur battery, which I think have an enormous potential. Sulfur as a reagent, as a chemical, is incredibly inexpensive. If you want, you know, a mountain of sulfur in your backyard, somebody will pay you to take it. It's about 4 cents a kilo or something like that. In Canada, they have pyramids.
It's the transportation, which is the expensive part.
Well, yeah, and in that case. And then, you know, the real chemistry of sulfur is complex, but it has an enormously high capacity. And so a lot of emphasis on trying to make that work.
That's a primary battery, right?
No, you can make secondary batteries.
You can make it secondary? How do you get the sulfur back to where it needs to be for that?
Hang on, gentlemen. Primary battery, secondary battery. Let's explain that a little.
So a primary battery is the energizer. Use it once and throw it away, right? So you,
like in a nuclear bomb, the first little explosion to condense everything, and
no,
then
no.
the secondary.
No, primary is that it's not rechargeable. It's what
discharge
it
once.
Yeah. Discharge once and discharge. And in this day and age of environmental anything, you know, you can't, you just can't do that.
Right.
Secondary batteries mean that you can recharge them more than once.
So it's just a matter of non-rechargeable versus chargeable
batteries.
That's
exactly right.
But
yeah,
you put
primary
and secondary.
Yeah, that's right.
Got it.
That's in the parlance of battery folks. And the lithium sulfur, so it depends on how you discharge the sulfur. But we've developed systems where you can charge them and discharge them up to about 1,000 times right now, which is really very good with very high capacities.
What's the holy grail there?
So the issue there is to make lithium sulfur work, you need a lithium metal anode. And that gets very, very, very difficult because, as our distinguished colleague here knows very well, lithium tends to make dendrites. And so dendrites can penetrate the separator, give rise to a dead short, and we're back to barbecue in your pocket because, you'll discharge the whole battery very
rapidly. Also, there's some discussion right now that lithium is kind of a rare element. People are going around trying to find lithium sources.
There's some truth to that. I think right now that's not going to be the limiting factor. They have this big salares, I don't know how you say that in English, the salt mines in Argentina and Chile where it's not ginormous, but enough right now to accommodate that. But then making lithium anodes is really very tricky. And so you want to make the metal deposit to be very smooth and not give rise to dendrites.
Is the role of lithium because it's the lightest of these electroactive, or is it a matter of the oxidation reduction potentials?
So both, actually. If you look with the periodic table that we have, which is not going to change anytime soon.
Gets bigger at the bottom from time to time.
Exactly. If you start, you have hydrogen. If you use hydrogen as an electrode material, we call it a fuel cell, right? Next one is helium, which is going to be very difficult. Next one after that is lithium. And so lithium has the most negative reduction potential, so it stores the most energy per electron. It's the lightest metal that can reversibly exchange an electron. And so the metric in batteries, even though the units are so-called milliamp hours per gram, if you do the dimensional analysis, milli is just 10 to the minus 3, so you can throw that away. Amps is coulombs per second, so charge per second, and then you multiply by time, right? So that's electrons per gram. So how many electrons per gram can you get? It's going to be very hard to get more than in lithium. And so it's as simple as that. It's not a complicated analysis.
I know there was a study that compared your lead-acid battery to a lithium battery of the same size and how much less it weighed and how much more energy was stored.
Yes. And so, for example, if you look, two points in there. One is the technologies that have the best market penetration are not necessarily the most revolutionary, right? Everybody has a lead-acid battery in his or her car. If you look at the energy density of a lead acid, it's about 40 watt hours per kilogram in that bulk, 40 to 50. A lousy lithium ion battery might have 150. And people are shooting to get maybe 200 to 300 to enable long range electric cars.
I want to change topics completely.
Sure.
Here. I don't usually learn new words when I see titles of lectures and stuff. But I saw a recent article or recent announcement of a talk you gave, and it said operando methods. And I thought, my God, I'm thinking of opera, and I'm thinking, I don't quite get that. Tell us about this term that you seem to have coined.
Sing. So my contention is all of these systems are very reactive. Lithium is an extremely reactive material. When you work with lithium to make a lithium-ion battery, you have a dry box. It cannot be nitrogen because lithium makes lithium nitride. So it has to be argon. And the ones that in which we work, we monitor oxygen and water religiously. And so we typically have less than 0.1 parts per million in the dry box to make sure that what we assemble is what we think we assemble. And so because these are so reactive interfaces, you can aside here, you can almost see in the experimental part of a manuscript, saying we open the cell and quickly transfer it to the spectrometer. I mean, unless quickly is a picosecond, you're dead in the water.
That's right.
And the literature is full of that, you know. Only briefly exposed, you know. A second is too long, right?
Yes.
And so then the counter to that is, so how can you investigate this system? So you need to develop probes and experimental methods that enable you to study these systems while they're operating as they were meant to. And so from that, the Latin word would be operando.
Did you ever try, I know that many years ago with Stan Whittingham, by the way, we built an X-ray diffractometer with a battery in it that we could charge and discharge and watch the expansion.
We do a lot of those measurements.
So that's what operando means.
Operando would mean that. So, for example, we're fortunate enough to have a synchrotron at Cornell, so we do a lot of battery cycling
right
and look at all these phase transitions, you know, under operating conditions. We've also developed a transmission electron microscope cell that you can do electrochemistry inside a TEM, which is a real trick. And we also develop methods to do mass spectrometry, so you can measure products of reactions while they're going on. It's called differential electrochemical mass spectrometry. So all of these methods collectively would be known as operando methods.
And so this is in the forefront of analytical chemistry.
Yes.
I mean, this is just doing things on the fly, almost.
Yes.
What have you learned? Because we've only got a few minutes left. What's the big thing that you've been able to discover using operando techniques?
So you learn, for example, in fuel cell materials, which we also do a lot of, that the active form of the catalyst, I mean, certainly bears some resemblance to what you put in, but it's not exactly what you put in. The surface composition changes, and it changes dramatically, and that's the active one. And so you need to be aware of that. Similarly, if you look at batteries, you undergo these phase transitions, you know, in a lot of materials, and there's some that are better than others in terms of allowing you to charge and discharge your battery effectively. And then also you can establish decomposition pathways, which are critical. I mean, all of these things, the lifetime is dictated by and large by site reactions. If you can get an understanding and control of that, then even, you know, an increase in stability by a factor or two can be the difference between something that's commercially viable or not. And so we have also, even though we're doing fundamental research, I think we should be aware of the fact that we are blessed to do the things we do because, you know, we have support from governments and other agencies, and we should be sensitive to those needs as well.
Do you have any little startup companies? This should be Russell's question, but I mean,
actually, there's one, you know, I have a former student of mine. His name is Yingchao Yu, who established a small startup company, battery company called Leo Nano, and they're doing exceptionally well. They're doing really, really well.
Leo Nano,
yeah. And then another one from another student of mine is a fuel cell battery called Ecolectro.
Hector, I'm afraid we've run out of time. We could be here all day and talk about many things.
There we go.
But thank you.
I'm going to have to come back.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think February, that would be a good time
February
for you to come back.
February is a good time to be away from Ithaca, yes.
Right, because you've been there long enough to know what's coming in February.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much for
being here. Thank you very much for the two of you for this delightful interview. Yeah.
And thanks to Lauren Tarazas, our producer, and also thanks to Dr. Stan Whittingham, who was just elected to the National Academy of Engineering.
Well done. Thank you very much for listening, and hasta la vista.